Welcome to Macro Musings, the podcast series where each week we pull back the curtain and take a closer look at the important macroeconomic issues of the past, present, and future. I'm your host, David Beckworth of the Mercatus Center. We are glad you've decided to join us. Our guest today is Stephen Williamson. Steve is a professor of economics at the University of Western Ontario and formerly was a vice president at the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. Steve is also the author of a popular macroeconomics textbook, and he blogs at New Monetarism. Steve joins us today to discuss New Monetarism, Neo-Fisherism, and some issues surrounding current Fed policy. Steve, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, David. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you on. We've interacted many times before in the blogosphere and on Twitter, so it's great to talk to you in person. Let's begin, as we do with all the guests on the show. How did you get into macroeconomics?
Well, so initially I was a math student, and I just liked math, but then the career possibilities didn't look so great. So I was looking around for something to do, and some of my friends suggested I take economics. So that seemed pretty interesting, and the focus on macro came later. So I went to work for the Bank of Canada. I had a master's degree. I got a master's degree in Canada, and then I went to work for the Bank of Canada. And then what would happen there is that I kind of had a job where we were, you know, it was like part of it was current analysis, so we had to pay attention to data. So I kind of got into, you know, kind of, you know, having to worry about measurement, and then we'd have like sort of like weekly, the head of the department would come in and he'd give us the latest update on what was going on with monetary policy. So that got pretty interesting. So I said, you know, I sort of got interested in the policy making and, you know, what the models had to do with the policy and et cetera. So that was kind of
that was the interest. Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize you worked at the Bank of Canada as well. So you've seen central banking on both sides of the border. You've seen Canadian central banking and U.S. central banking.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, that's interesting. We'll come back to that a little bit later. We'll talk about where the Fed's taking its balance sheet, because Canada has a great example, a great comparison for the U.S. But before we get to that, I want to talk about some of the areas where you've made some contributions, some original work of your own, and some stuff that's controversial, interesting, and I'll let you know that you've actually been requested by our listeners. So you're here by popular demand, Steve. Now, I've had a number of people email me and say they want to hear you talk about neo-Fisherism. We'll get to that in a minute. Before we do that, though, I want to talk about your New Monetarism literature, and I don't want to call it a school of thought, but you've pushed a New Monetarism research agenda. So tell us what it is and what is it trying to do?
The name came from, you know, so it's like Randy Wright was sitting next to me at dinner one night. You know, we were in Cleveland for a conference there, and then he had this idea that we needed a name, that somehow this would help to get the research program more attention. And I think it was his suggestion. So that this, you know, what you went through sort of what else was taken, and we thought, well, New Monetarism, that would work, because we thought we maybe had something in common with the old quantity theorists. We were different from them in some ways, but maybe we had more of an interest in the longer run rather than the short run, and we certainly weren't, you know, we weren't entirely on board with New Keynesian economics. Not so much because of the sticky prices, but more the lack of attention to financial detail and the explicitness about central banks and how they work. So what's New Monetarism? The idea was that we thought it was important, and this, you know, the ideas came from back in, you know, uh, I guess the root of it would be kind of like Minnesota monetary economics. You know, we were influenced, both of us, you know, Randy and I and other people, like indirectly, say, like Ricardo Lagos, Guillaume Rocheteau, they work in this area. Well, lots of other people. So the idea was that you gain a lot from being explicit about why money is useful, why other assets are useful in exchange, and to try to explain those things, you had to dig deeper into fundamental frictions in the economy that create a need for asset exchange and financial intermediation and use of collateral, et cetera. So, and if you're explicit about that, that you get a lot more insight into what's going on. You know, there's sort of a, yes, it's through this literature, you know, this, so this goes back to, say, the time when, you know, even like Lucas's work. So Lucas, way back in, you know, 1972, wrote this paper called Expectations and the Neutrality of Money. And in it, he kind of did that. So there's part of what he wants to do is to try to explain the, you know, Phillips curve correlations and the, you know, the role of monetary policy in that context. But then he had this, what he did was he made use of this little model. So there was a, you know, this model that Samuelson wrote down in the 1950s, an overlapping generations model that you could actually use as a model of money, basic frictions that would give you where people would use this stuff, and the people in the model would pick it up and use it without, you know, the modeler telling them they had to use it, basically. And so then other people kind of picked up on that. Lucas kind of abandoned the thing, but then the Minnesota people, so primarily Neil Wallace, kind of picked up on this, and then a lot of his students worked on it. And then so he kind of had this rationale for why you wanted to do monetary economics explicitly. And then there were sort of other modeling frameworks that came along, sort of like Randy Wright's work, you know, Kiyotaki and Wright, et cetera. And what you'd think of as kind of like a search approach to monetary economics, where the part of the friction was, you know, people searching around for people to trade with, and money kind of made the trade easier. And those models kind of evolved into this, what's used a lot now is a kind of Lagos-Wright framework. Now it's not like the principles that we kind of think of as important in this literature kind of tied to this model particularly. It's not like the model itself is the thing, you know, that's a vehicle for doing the work, you know, and a lot of people who work in this area.
So the Lagos-Wright model was kind of the 2005 was kind of the seminal model where they took money seriously. They viewed in this kind of a search framework. Is that right?
Yeah. Though eventually it's not specifically search. So
okay.
So what we learned, I guess the most important thing we learned in kind of post, you know, I guess so post 1980 monetary economics was that it's like the information frictions that are mm-hmm. important. So there's this idea, Kocher Lakota kind of tacked a name onto this, you know, so the idea is that money is memory, you know, and the idea is that there's sort of record keeping is important and safer, you know, if you thought of the alternative to monetary exchange as being credit, you know, part of what makes credit work is information, credit histories, so it's when the credit histories aren't all there that the, you know, there's a role for assets in exchange and then when what we might call money.
So when I think of new monetarism, what I hear you saying is you and the other folks in this literature were early on taking seriously the explicit modeling of financial intermediation, banks, firms, medium of exchange, assets that facilitate transaction. And
yeah.
And that to me, and I've done a little, I've tinkered with it with Josh Hendrickson. And I find that really refreshing when you look at the alternatives. When you have a standard DSGE models, you have the money in the utility function or cash in advance constraint. Those don't really motivate money. They just put them in there. They just use them. They assume them. Where my understanding of what you guys are doing is that you actually, you know, justify a reason for money and then put it to use. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So and there's a limit to that, you know. So mm-hmm. so for models to be useful, they have to be simple, and so you know you're trying to be explicit, but there's a limit to how much explicitness you can have, and at some stage, you know, you have to make some assumptions and proceed from there. But yeah, the idea is that in a lot of contexts that you could go very wrong if you stuff assets into the utility function and proceed from there.
Yeah. Now, how are you different than old monetarism? What specific ways? I mean, you still buy into the quantity theory, right? Or not?
Oh, gee, you know, so that's not clear. So the there's this idea that. Yeah. So here's what I think.
the Steve Williamson's version. Okay.
So when we use this word new monetarism, some people don't even like it. I was talking to Ricardo Lagos. He doesn't even like using the name. And Randy Wright and I say we might disagree about stuff.
So that's okay.
There's not like anything anybody's necessarily entirely agreed on here. But one thing we might agree on, if you looked at Milton Friedman. So Milton Friedman was he was not that interested in explicit theory. He kind of he had. Pretty sharp mind, and you read some of his work and the way he kind of fleshes out these ideas, you know, like optimum quantity of money or something. That paper, you know, he kind of verbally, you know, lays out a theoretical framework, but he doesn't write it down explicitly. And then he's pretty good at kind of deriving all these implications and things that people later fleshed out explicitly. But he wasn't a big fan of delving into explicit theoretical structures, you know. And he had an empirical mind, and there's this kind of, you know, what people would have thought of as the, you know, the monetarist black box. You know, there's this, you could somehow measure this stuff, you know, that we call money. And then that was important for everything. You know, whatever it is, you know, we aggregate a bunch of assets and we call that money, and that's driving business cycles. And that's the thing that the central bank should focus on. They should target the growth in that thing, and that'll do wonderful stuff, etc. You know, so the difference, say, with what we might call new monetarism is more of an interest in the theory, and also the financial intermediation. That certainly wasn't right. Friedman's thing. You know, if you look at how he thought about the Great Depression, he wasn't interested in the kind of the intermediation process and what might have gone wrong with it, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of turns up like say in some of Bernanke's work on the Depression, right, or something. He starts thinking about the kind of intermediary frictions and what that might have to do with what was going on.
Well, one way to think about this, Milton Friedman was really concerned about the medium of exchange role and what happened to that, where Bernanke brings out the financial intermediation shocks. And I think I see new monetarism, you're looking at both of those. You take both of those ideas seriously, both you know, what is the transaction asset? How does it work? But also financial intermediation, and how do they complement each other? How are they important to the economy? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yep. So you would be then also broader in your perspective than kind of a standard New Keynesian model. So in those models, monetary policy is solely a function of the gap between, you know, the expected path of the short-term interest rate and the natural short-term interest rate. And that expected, you know, path of interest rates versus natural interest rate, that spread there is what shapes monetary policy. And I think, you know, the old monetarists would say, well, it's much more than just that. It's a wide, you know, span of assets and relative prices. And I sense that you're sympathetic to that point, that monetary policy is much more than just short-term interest rates relative to the natural rate.
Yeah, and so yeah, some of New Keynesian economics kind of gets away from this, you know. So if you look at, oh, say what, you know, like what Mark Gertler works on, mm-hmm. You know, he pays more attention to the, you know, the intermediation, et
right.
cetera.
So credit's become more important since the crisis, but kind of going into the 2008.
But the baseline New Keynesian models are, you know, don't have any assets in them. They take it all out. So it's not only does it not have any, you know, medium of exchange in there, there's no money. There's, you know, it's also, it's, you know, the markets are all complete, and the, you know, the only friction in there is the sticky prices. So it's purely about these sticky prices and sticky wages and the wedges they create. And so you got these distortions that monetary policy, so-called monetary policy, can mitigate somehow. But monetary policy in those models is kind of a funny thing. It's just it's like as if the central bank could go out and dictate a short-term nominal interest rate. They just say what it is, and there's nothing in there about how they accomplish that, which to me is the interesting part. You know, so is the looking at taking it, you know, like say taking the central bank and looking at it for what it is, which is, you know, it's a financial intermediary. So it's doing some kind of asset transformation. It's got a portfolio of assets, and it's got mm-hmm. some liabilities. And question is what's that asset transformation about, and what exactly should this institution be doing? How should you design it, and then how should it, what's monetary policy all about? How does it work? And
yep.
you know, how it works is going to have to do with that asset transformation that it does.
Right. So you and your fellow new monetarists are very careful, very explicit about the theory behind central banking, monetary policy. You want good, deep theory. Now, we recently interviewed Bill Barnett, all right? And he's, you know, the father of the divisio monetary measures. And he kind of, you know, goes on the other side of this question and says, we need theory to have good measurement, and that the way money is being measured is not very precise. Simple sum it's nonsense. You're treating, for example, currency and time deposits as equivalents in terms of purchasing power, liquidity. So he's gotten really rigorous with the measurement side, and I'm just curious: what are your thoughts on using divisia monetary aggregates?
Oh, gee. So the extent I've been exposed to it, it's okay. For me, it's not too helpful. I know it's like then the whole approach. I guess I can see I can see the motivation. So it's like You know, we're more macroeconomists, and we have to somewhere we got it. We have to aggregate, you know. So, but it's still kind of good. You know, this is still going back to this monetarist idea that somehow we can separate the, you know, what's money from what's not, and the truth is that you know, there's a whole spectrum of assets in terms of liquidity and other characteristics. And these assets play very different roles sometimes. Sometimes they're roles that are related. And, you know, I don't know how you can maybe think seriously about you know, trying to aggregate a bunch of stuff, call it money, and think that you got something that's useful for anything. You know, so yeah. So the
I think he would reply that he acknowledges your point. Not everything is equally liquid. They're very different assets, and his attempt, his work, has been to try to, you know, somehow use index theory, aggregation theory, in a scientific way to kind of combine them in a meaningful measure, kind of like the CPI does for, you know, the price of goods and services. But anyway, let's move on. Let's move on to neo-Fisherism, where you've kind of made a big splash past few years. And again, as I mentioned earlier,
whether it's a splash, I don't know.
Well, you've definitely left an impression with many people, and I mean, again, I've had people email me and say, when are you going to get Stephen Williamson on the show to talk about neo-Fisherism? So to all those listeners who've emailed, here we are. It's going to begin right now. So tell us, Steve, what is neo-Fisherism?
Oh, what is it? Yeah, so the name. I mean, this is like Noah Smith came up with the.
Oh, he did. Okay, interesting.
He came up with the name, and you know, where did it come from exactly? So it's like the. And John Cochran was talking about some of these things, but
yes.
You know, so for me, it was like trying to. Just trying to understand this recent experience with inflation, like, or from the time of the financial crisis. So mm-hmm. so we had this period, you know, where the Fed started to expand the size of the balance sheet, and I started looking at this. I thought, well, surely this has to cause inflation. And then I started to think up a story for why that was so. So like I'm doing this in blog posts. So I'm kind of not writing it down. And then I kind of think I got something. But then, you know, what was helpful about that is people keep asking me questions. You know, so then I keep trying to explain it. And then eventually it's kind of not making sense. And then and then you start kind of exploring this in various models. And then it, and then, you know, looking at the data. So it's like the basic idea is that we've always thought, you know, I think it's been considered kind of just conventional wisdom that central bank increases the nominal interest rate and that's going to make inflation go down in the short run. But anyway, we kind of always knew about this Fisher effect that sets in the long run, and usually, you know, everybody's kind of used to the causality running from inflation to nominal interest rates, you know, so inflation, high inflation causes nominal interest rates to be high. Now I was also familiar with this, you know, there's a literature on liquidity effects. People started doing this stuff in there's some kind of early models in the, you know, 1980s, but it's kind of around 1990. Lucas kind of promoted the ideas, and Tim Fierce, who was one of his students, worked on this. Christiano Eichenbaum did a bunch of empirical work on it. So there are kind of a whole class of models that went with this. So people thinking about liquidity effects of monetary policy. Now the way they thought of this was in terms of like central banks controlling monetary aggregates. You know, so suppose, you know, central bank controls money growth. Now what we knew was that in, you know, sort of conventional models that that a lot of people use, they're sort of run-of-the-mill kind of cash-in-advance models, that it's kind of an anticipated inflation matters in these models. That you know, so money growth goes up, inflation goes up, and people are anticipating higher inflation if the increase in money growth is permanent, and that just gives you a Fisher effect, the nominal interest rate goes up. So everybody thought, well, gee, you know, that's not what happens. You know, what happens is that central banks, you know, increase money growth and nominal interest rate goes down in the short run. That's a liquidity effect.
Right.
So then people wrote down some models that would give you that, you know, and they were kind of like models with distribution effects in them, kind of, you know, it's like a model where the
limited participation
round,
models.
Yeah. Limited participation, segmented markets, yeah. type models. Fernando Alvarez, he worked on these things, a lot, for instance. So what's true in that model? And so what happened was this, so I kind of explored, you know, what's actually going on in some of these models. Now, the way that they tell the story was in terms of money growth. So it's like, you know, again, it's like, suppose money growth increases permanently. Well, what these models will have the property that in the short run, nominal interest rate goes down, but in the long run, the Fisher effect kicks in, and the nominal interest rate will go up. You know, so you know, some models, you know, got a real interest rate isn't affected in the long run, and then what will happen is you kind of get a long run 1-for-1 increase in the nominal interest rate with a, you know, from an increase in money growth. Well, so question is, what happens if you've got a central bank which is pegging nominal interest rates in the very short run, which is how they operate, right? Since, you know, this kind of quantitative, you know, what central banks did in the 70s and 80s was to do a kind of quantity theory experiment. They were targeting money growth rates, and then, you know, that eventually that didn't work so well, you know, to do what they were trying to accomplish. So they start targeting, overnight nominal interest rates, and that's the way they formulate policy. And then, you know, Taylor comes along with this rule and kind of, you know, gives people something to kind of, you know, a way to think explicitly about this nominal interest rate targeting. And, you know, this is what central banks do. So question is, if you're How's monetary policy going to work in the context of nominal interest rate targeting? And so here's an experiment. So experiment might be nominal interest rate goes up 1% permanently. What happens? Well, it turns out in one of these liquidity effect models, so the thing's got the darn liquidity effect in there that the response to higher money growth is in the short run the nominal interest rate goes down, but if you increase the nominal interest rate permanently and in the working in the background is the, you know, central bank's got to be manipulating, you know, quantities in order to accomplish that. They got to be doing the open market operations in the background that supports the higher nominal interest rate permanently. That what happens in those models in response to that is that the inflation doesn't go down. It just goes up, not 1-for-1 initially because you got this liquidity effect in there. But you got to have a really big liquidity effect in order for the inflation rate to go down in response to an increase in the nominal interest rate. And eventually the Fisher effect takes over in the long run, and and you get the 1-for-1 increase, you know, and in this case, it's like, you know, so this is the way we kind of have to think about it, that it's like the, you know, we think more generally, not just in terms of that experiment, but in terms of policy rules and how they work, that it's, you know, if you're in this world where you've got central banks following policy rules where they, you know, what the instrument they're working on is a short-term nominal interest rate. Indeed, it is, you know, it's the nominal interest rate that's causing inflation. And so what do we know about this? You know, so it's like there's some other results in the literature, like to do with Taylor rules and how they work. So that's kind of the crux of it, you know, is the question is what's the right policy rule for the central bank, you know, and what's the, you know, is it a kind of conventional Taylor rule or what is it, you know? So
let me just, before we get too far into the policy implications, let's just summarize again the basic idea behind neo-Fisherism, and that is, contrary to maybe conventional wisdom, what you argue with neo-Fisherism, that is, if you permanently raise the short-term rate, eventually inflation will also permanently go up, maintaining that Fisher relationship. Is that right?
And even further than that, if you know that it's like the conventional Taylor rule,
mm-hmm.
Tells you that what the central bank should do is, you know, if inflation goes up 1%, the nominal interest rate target should go up more than 1%.
Right. The Taylor principle.
Taylor principle. Now, this, you know, a neo-Fisherian idea would be that not only is the magnitude of that response wrong, but the sign's wrong too. That in fact the right rule would be one where in response to an increase in inflation, you go the other way. you actually reduce the nominal interest rate.
Now, obviously, and you've gotten this feedback, you've gotten it from me, many other people, though, that just seems so counterintuitive to everything we've been taught, right? That's just so against the grain. And that's why it's made such a big splash. I know you've written about this formally, and John Cochran's written. I know John Cochran's taken a new Keynesian model to show this actually happens in the model, too. So
it happens in a new Keynesian model with a Phillips curve in it.
Yeah, which is surprising.
Because the Phillips curve's in there, and you know, this is what happens. This is what happens in conventional rational expectations models.
Let me flesh this out a little bit. So I was talking to David Andelfato about this, and he's trying to wrap his mind around it as well. And you guys used to be colleagues at St. Louis Fed. And he came to this conclusion, and this made it a little easier for me to understand. I want to hear your take on his perspective on how this could be true. He argued that the story you described can happen. You can permanently raise short-term rates and inflation eventually goes up, but only if you've got fiscal policy in the background supporting that action. So in other words, kind of, you know, the knee-jerk conventional view would be, well, man, if you raise rates, you're tightening policy. But what David said was, well, if you've got fiscal policy, you know, providing stimulus, whatever it's needed to get that inflation up, you can do this. Is that kind of a missing piece of the story? Do you buy that? Or
No, I don't. Yeah, see, I don't buy it.
Okay.
So we would argue endlessly.
Oh, you and David would? Okay.
About that, you know, so I think it's not right.
So you don't think it depends on fiscal supportive fiscal policy? It's just pure, okay.
No. So it's on. Yeah. So I was thinking about some of these things recently. Like to do. It's kind of like a. If you're familiar with fiscal theory, the price level, it's kind of that idea. You know, there's a bit of, you know, what David's talking about, it's a bit of the idea, you know, it's a bit of like the fiscal theorists, you know, who I think there are various shades of the fiscal theory. You know, it's a little hard to understand sometimes, but it seems to be, you know, the extreme view is that, you know, it's like fiscal policy is driving everything.
So you're saying David is invoking the fiscal theory to make for himself to make the Neo Fisher.
I think that's what he's saying, you know. But
you don't buy that. You're saying no.
Yeah. The argument might be that, you know, so if you're in a world with, you're a central bank conducting open market operations. So suppose in the background, like I said, you know, it's like there's somehow the nominal quantities have to be increasing, you know. So you want sustained higher inflation. It's true that, you know, in fact, nominal assets have to be growing over time. So I guess David's thinking, well, that also means, you know, that nominal government debt has to be growing over time. Right. If you've got a sustained inflation
that's probably the hardest disconnect for most people would be. You're raising, so on one hand, you're raising mm-hmm. rates. On the other hand, you're going to get this permanent increase in inflation. Typically, we think of a permanent increase in inflation because government liabilities are growing faster, right? There's a higher, but you have found a way mm-hmm. to reconcile those two things. Is that what I hear you saying?
So the one way to look at it might be, you know, so it's like, the question you might ask is people used to say that hyperinflations came from the central bank basically monetizing the debt, right. Monetizing the government debt. Well, you know, a lot of these QE operations, the debt's being monetized, all right, you know. Japan, you know, they monetized a huge amount of the huge portion of the government debt. You know, the Fed monetized a bunch of debt, but it didn't create inflation. How come? You know, if you read some of these accounts of hyperinflations, then the people are describing what's going on, and it appears that, you know, the central bank's monetizing the government debt. So sometimes it appears to create inflation, sometimes not. How come? so the answer might be that the instances where you get high inflation, like in Argentina, or hyperinflations, like we've seen historically, is cases where the government's forcing the central bank to make a lot of transfers to it. It's the transfers that kind of matter. So the way what creates transfers from the central bank to the government is a big interest rate spread. You know, so they, you know, historically that's been the spread between the nominal yield on currency, which is zero, and the nominal yield on the central bank's assets. Now, what's gonna create these large transfers is a high nominal interest rate. You know, so another way to think of it is in terms of just the asset pricing relationships if the nominal interest rate goes up, then something has to adjust. And, you know, what is it? You know, so it's like, ultimately, the asset markets need to equilibrate, and ultimately, what part of what has to adjust is the inflation rate. You can think of some of that happening kind of through the interface between asset markets and the markets for goods and services. But basically, you have to have this adjustment in inflation in response to nominal interest rates, which is being pegged by the central bank. And so it's like a central bank can create, I'm convinced, you know, a central bank can create as much inflation as it wants. And it's, unless the the fiscal arm of the government or the government itself, you say, can ultimately control things if it wants to dictate what the central bank does. But an independent central bank, even if it's not, doesn't have suppose it's like doing open market operations. So it's like you're creating the money, through open market operations requires having government, a ready supply of nominal government debt to buy to generate the inflation, but it can do it other ways. Can do it through central bank lending.
Let me ask this question. So, before I do that, you asked earlier. Sometimes it appears. Central banks can create inflation, like hyperinflation, monetizing debt. Other times, like QE in Japan, hasn't. My answer. I know you know this. And I'll just throw this out there. We'll move on though. Is it depends on whether that monetary injection is expected to be permanent or not. If it's temporary. And of course, that depends on what fiscal policy is doing as well. But I think that's one plausible explanation. But let me come back to your story, the neo-Fisherism story. Do you have some good case studies or examples you can point to that support this take?
Oh, the best example is Japan. So you want to interpret that in terms of temporary and permanent. Oh, geez, it looks to me like these, the QE experiments. Why aren't those permanent? it's kind of well known that you can have, if you think in terms of monetary injections, that it kind of, the effects depend on how the money's injected, and the temporary and permanent can matter. If you make the promise, you make the commitment that you're going to withdraw the cash later on, if done in a particular way, that can have no effect at all. But I don't think that's what's going on here. I don't think we've got this long history in Japan of, if it were true that low nominal interest rates eventually makes inflation go up, surely after 22 years of low nominal interest rates in Japan, the inflation should have gone up, and it never did.
Well, I'll play devil's advocate here. The new Keynesian would say, well, yeah, but they didn't lower rates low enough, right? That the natural rate had fallen. But look, I hear your point. So what you point to as empirical evidence is not necessarily a case where central bank raised rates and you had higher inflation, but kind of the opposite of that, right? Where they kept it low and you didn't get, the inflation that was expected. So,
and we kind of know this, this is like kind of what we know from theory, pretty robust kind of result, is the kind of Taylor rule result. You follow you got the central bank that follows the Taylor principle in the model. What happens is eventually they end up at the zero lower bound and they get stuck there. Stuck there, and that seems to be a nice description of what a lot of central banks have got themselves into.
So let me just ask, what is your sense of the acceptance of neo-Fisherism? I know you and John Cochran are probably the most vocal, well-known advocates of it. Are other people kind of joining the chorus?
So you kind of get two reactions. You kind of get one reaction is just, oh, well, that's obvious. the other reaction is disbelief, and that's kind of, I think a lot of what explains that is just there's this idea of, there are central bankers, I think, who's, the model they have in the back of their heads is just basic kind of ISLM Phillips curve with fixed expectations. What happens in that model is, nominal interest rate goes up, real rate goes up, that makes output go down, and you move down the Phillips curve and you get less inflation. That's what they're accustomed to. So that's so well ingrained as an idea. That's become everybody's intuition about how the world actually works. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know why they do it, but people will tend to ignore the what they, they'll tend to ignore what they see in the data. They have data that's inconsistent with, you know, a Phillips curve idea, and they, you know, that doesn't seem to bother anybody. Or bothers them a little bit, but then they seem to find a way to convince themselves that everything's okay.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to another topic, the time we have left. I want to move on to your critique of QE, or quantitative easing, or the large-scale asset purchases. The main theory that was used to justify them, there's two, but the main one was the portfolio balance channel. The signaling channel was also invoked as well. But the portfolio balance channel is kind of the main argument for why these purchases actually mattered. But you argued, I think, from the beginning that they, for the most part, that they weren't that important. Maybe some effect on the margin, but they really weren't that consequential. So tell us why you're critical of the portfolio channel theory. Well, maybe let's talk through the assumptions of the portfolio channel, and then you know, tell us why they're wrong and why it doesn't work.
Yeah. So what is, you know, the portfolio balance? You know, when somebody says that, you know, if you read Bernanke's speeches, you know, he'd have citations in there, he'd have references, and he'd talk about like Tobin. So yep. An example would be like Tobin's 1969 paper. I think this is like an inaugural issue of the JMCB or something. He's got a little like three asset model. It's like a static model, or asset demands and asset supplies, and you move quantities around in there. You have central banks do open market operations, and it matters. Well, you could take one of those models. You could add something you call long-term debt, long-term government debt. So you could have demands and supplies for short government debt and long government debt. So if we think of like QE, the different kinds of QE, but one kind of QE would just be a central bank swaps reserves for long maturity government debt. Well, you write down one of these Tobin models, little static model, and that's gonna matter. You do swaps like Operation Twist, that'll matter, all right, because you're changing relative asset supplies, and by assumption the markets are all segmented. We don't have financial intermediaries that intermediate across maturities in there, and we don't have any dynamics, lots of things we don't have in that kind of world. But the basic assumption is that there's some kind of market segmentation that you can play off, imperfect arbitrage and the central bank can somehow exploit that and vary relative asset supplies and affect prices.
The central bank has a special financial intermediary that can bridge the gap. That they can do things that other banks can't do. Is that another assumption of this?
Yeah, that's important. You know, so now let's start to think about that a bit. You know, like what's special about the central bank? So typically, I think we think that, you know, the conventional policy that works in part because of the monopoly the central bank has on currency, this old kind of old fashioned medium of exchange we have that only the central bank can issue, typically in most countries. There's some subtleties in the U.S. about this, but basically the Fed's got a monopoly on the supply of currency, and then the intermediation there, it's like basically the Fed's purchasing government debt, which can't be used in transactions, and converting that into some stuff that can be used in transactions. Well, it seems like that should matter, and that's the basis, I guess, for why a central bank matters. Now, there have been all kinds of debates about what's the, what's the base, you know, what's the basis for the, you know, granting the central bank a monopoly on the supply of currency. And there are people around who, you know, think that was a bad idea, you know, that there should be private currency supply. You know, we've had cases in the past of private banks issuing currency. Sometimes that seems to have worked okay, you know, so you know, some debate about that, but suppose we just take it for granted. So now, well, we're thinking about unconventional policy. Well, as you know, if that's going to work and work, you know, to make us better off, you know, it better be true that the central bank somehow has an advantage in whatever it is that it's doing when it does QE. So what would that be? So QE is typically taking, you know, so you just take the simplest one, which is purchasing, you know, purchasing long treasuries. Say you're the Fed, you purchase long maturity treasury securities. And you turn those into reserves. So the Fed's taking long maturity treasuries, converting that stuff into overnight assets. Now, what advantage does it have in doing that? Well, one, you know, first thing you might want to ask is did it actually do anything useful there? So are the reserves actually more useful in some sense than the long maturity treasuries are? So there's some question about that. You know, so some people who talk about like financial plumbing worry about that. And they worry about the fact that, you know, the reserves are only held by a fraction of financial institutions. There's the things that people have talked about to do with what they call balance sheet costs that are associated with reserve holding. And those are actually, you know, you can write down models of this, and those are actually real resource costs in some sense. So the Fed in doing a QE operation like that has taken useful treasuries out of the financial market. Treasuries are, you know, supporting the repo market, for instance, you know, even long maturity treasuries can be highly, highly liquid. 10-year treasuries, that's a very, very useful asset. You're taking those out of the market and giving the market reserves, which maybe that's not so great. No, but then you could think of, what's the private sector doing? So there are things we might call shadow banks and other, you know, other financial institutions that could do the same thing. They can hold long maturity treasuries and convert those into overnight repos. So they can do that. They're taking the long treasuries, converting them into overnight assets. And why is it that they can't do such a great job of that, and the Fed is so good at it? You know, so it's not clear. I mean, if you think about it that way, that this would actually accomplish anything, you know. Mm-hmm. In fact, it might go the other way. You might actually be doing harm by, you know. So not that things like this couldn't work. So it could be that if you think about what QE might accomplish, you know, so some of what I talked about was just, you know, that maybe reserves are kind of a crappy asset. Well, maybe if the Fed wants to get into the business of debt management, you know, which is kind of what this is. You know, it's kind of like, you know, what they seem to think they could do was to shorten the maturity of the outstanding liabilities of the Treasury plus the Fed, right? And that would do some good. Well, maybe they could do that. Maybe, you know, if they wanted to do debt management, then maybe they, if they really wanted to get into that business, which maybe there should be a public discussion about that, because it's like debt management is something that was kind of assigned to the Treasury, right? So if the Fed really wanted to get into that business, maybe it needs some other liabilities. Maybe it should have the ability to issue things that look like T-bills, some other central banks can do that. Not that they do a lot of it necessarily, but Swiss National Bank can issue central bank bills. There's an argument, this is like a Jeremy Stein argument, that the Fed's reverse repos are actually pretty good assets, and that there would be some advantage to it, like expanding the reverse repo program.
He wants to keep a large balance sheet because the Fed's balance sheet, the reverse repo, opens up access to the Fed's balance sheet for these non-bank financial firms. But if they're going to do that, I think that's something Congress should probably approve. I mean, as you said earlier, you know, legally, fiscal policy has been delegated to the Treasury. You know, and I'd mention just, you know, the whole debt management angle. I mean, the Fed is in a losing battle against the Treasury. The Fed holds about 19-20% of outstanding marketable Treasury securities. So,
right.
I mean, it's kind of goes back to your earlier point. It's doing a lot of what other financial intermediaries are doing. Maybe a little bit bigger than some, but it's still a bit player compared to, you know, 80% of the other holders of Treasuries. Another point I want to raise with you, and this is the point Michael Woodford raised in his 2012 Jackson Hole paper, and I think it's in line with your point that the Fed isn't really that unique, at least in normal circumstances. It's not that unique. Its only unique role is swapping, you know, Treasuries for currency. When it's swapping reserves for Treasuries, it really isn't that unique. And he goes on and talks about, kind of tells the story. I'm kind of summarizing his words here, but he goes, look, the argument, another way to think of the argument for QE is that the Fed was going to pull duration risk or interest rate risk off of the private sector's balance sheet, and it was going to take it, you know, it was going to free up the private sector. They could then, you know, go do fun things, rebalance their portfolios to have riskier assets, and it'd be a wonderful world. But he notes that duration risk hasn't been eliminated. It's simply been transferred from the private sector to the Fed's balance sheet. And should the Fed have problems because of that, who's going to bail them out? The taxpayers. So the taxpayers really haven't gotten rid of the duration risk.
It's not like he can get rid of it.
Yeah, they just moved it around. They've masked it. They've put it in somewhere. The aggregate balance sheet of the U.S. economy still holds the same amount of risk, is what his point is. And I think that speaks to what you're saying, too, is that the Fed really isn't that unique in normal times. Now, I do think during QE1, you could make that argument that maybe the Fed was doing something that the rest of the financial system wasn't doing because markets were literally freezing up.
Yeah, so in the context, you know, it's like once, you know, you're in a crisis and the all bets are off, you know, and inflation control goes out the window and that's a very important role for the central bank,
right.
and then you may do unusual things.
But your critique and Woodford's critique, I think, applies to QE2, QE3 very acutely, in the sense that by that point we hadn't gotten back to more normal, you know, conditions. Financial markets were working, you know. So at that point, these critiques do come into play. Let me move on real quick because we're running out of time here. The Fed has been on a path now to reduce its balance sheet. It is now shrinking it by letting these securities run off. When they mature, they don't reinvest the funds. So we know it wants to shrink. It's outlined a specific plan to shrink, how much it's going to do. What it hasn't given us clearly is this destination. Where are we going to take the balance? How small will it get? And we all know that it will still, no matter how small it gets, it'll be bigger than it was in 2008 because currency demand growth has occurred. But the question is it going to stay large enough so that it keeps a floor system, or small enough that it could become a true corridor system? And speak to that, those differences. And what has Canada done? Because it briefly had a large balance sheet too, and it's come back down.
Just for a year, you know, so it, and that was kind of interesting, you know. So it's the institutional setup's very different, you know. So it's like the overnight markets are different here, you know. The what's called the large value transfer system in Canada just has, if I might got my numbers right, at least in this vicinity, like the 15 or 16 participants, you know. So that's those are the institutions that are actually potentially holding reserve balances. And so, yeah, of course, in the U.S., it's entirely different. You know, there are many, mm-hmm. many, you know, there are thousands of institutions holding reserve balances. There are a lot of traders on the Fed funds market. That's a lot of traders in the repo market, et cetera. You know, so it's kind of a different setup. But here's what happened. You know, so it's like the. Over what is it like 2000 I guess 2009 is it like 2009 to 2010 I think spring 2009 to spring 2010 they had they operated a floor system here, but they did it with not much reserves in the system. They targeted I'm thinking $3 billion overnight in reserve balances. So you take Canada to be about a tenth of the U.S. You know, it's Canadian dollars, but you know, roughly that's, you know, like 30 equivalent of like 30 billion, you know, U.S. So, you know, Canada has no reserve requirements. So they could actually operate a floor system with not much reserves. So I think that's true in the U.S. too. But you know, so my guess is if you got the balance, you got it down to like $100 billion. Now the question is whether you count the reverse repos or not. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. I guess you count the total. I guess, you know, but total of reverse repos plus reserves. If you got that down to $100 billion, you could still operate this floor system, which is a funny floor system too. Given the
What do you think is better, a floor system or a corridor system?
Oh, it depends. You know, some people at the New York Fed made the argument that they thought that the floor system would be good partly because of what happens in the daytime. You know, so this is a bit in the weeds maybe, but. Something people don't. Well, maybe people need to think more about this sort of thing. But the has to do with daylight payments. So what people noticed was that when reserves were scarce, say that's the usual terminology. I don't know if that's the greatest word for what's actually going on when you're operating a corridor. Effectively, before the financial crisis, the U.S. was a corridor system. It's just that, you know, they're paying zero on reserves overnight, and the discount rate was above the Fed funds rate, and they're targeting the Fed funds rate in between. So there's an argument like pre-financial crisis that the you get these kind of congestion effects in the overnight market that people kind of delay payment. The financial institutions would delay payments till the end of the day, because they, sort of for efficiency reasons. You know, they from their point of view, for the whole market, the argument was it wasn't efficient because there'd be sort of congestion in payments that they, you know, toward the end of the day. So there's an argument that if you had you have the large balance sheet and the system's flush with reserves, that there's not the same concern. So you wouldn't get this kind of congestion. So you'd save something on that margin. Though I think there may be other ways to correct that problem, even if you had the kind of small balance sheet. Operationally, it's not like it makes so much difference, you know. So one argument people made before way back. So this is like something, you know, you could read and like say some of the stuff that Marvin Goodfriend wrote way back. He would have said, oh, the floor system would be great in the U.S. because all you have to do is announce an interest rate on reserves, and that pegs the, you know, that'll peg the overnight rate, and you're done. So the procedure before the financial crisis was this kind of funny thing, you know, where the Fed would target the Fed funds rate, but they weren't actually intervening in the Fed funds market. They're actually intervening in the repo market. The question is why they, you know, why the Fed funds rate, and why not? Why wouldn't they target a repo rate if they're intervening in the repo market? So that, some of these things don't necessarily make sense, and it's a sort of historical accident that, you know, created all these ways of, you know, this particular method of implementing monetary policy in the U.S. So. Yeah. So one argument was that it would just be easy. The implementation would be easy in a floor system. The implementation might be easy in the floor system. Maybe you'd have some improvement in these daylight payments among financial institutions with a lot of reserves in the system, etc. Now, whether, I don't know, that you might be able to shoot down all those arguments. You know, it's kind of a matter of sort of what the outstanding liabilities of the central bank are, you know, that are going to determine what we call a floor system and what's not a floor system, for instance. And if you want, you know, it could be that you do want to have these reverse repos outstanding. Maybe Jeremy Stein's argument is correct, you know, that those are kind of useful assets, and that's kind of a, you know, it's like his argument was that the Treasury's not issuing enough T-bills, basically, and the Fed can correct that problem by having the big balance sheet and having a lot of reverse repos outstanding, you know.
Yeah. Of course, there's a cost to that as well, and that's a bigger footprint for the Fed on the financial system. But on that note, we've run out of time, and we have to end, unfortunately. Our guest today has been Stephen Williamson. Steve, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks a lot, David. Glad to have done it.
Macro Musings is produced by the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. If you haven't already, please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And while you're there, please consider rating us and leaving a review. This helps other thoughtful people like you find the podcast. Thanks for listening.